you get drenched anyway. Oh wow, there's some sound. It's okay, thanks. And then you wish you'd brought an umbrella with you. Or with a painting also, if there's just a small change, you can see that it can make enough difference to totally destroy something. So small things can do a lot more damage than big things. And a big lie often does us no harm at all, because we know it's a lie and we put up our guard. I think about, for example, if I were to go and visit a Kingdom Hall where the Jehovah's Witnesses meet, I would be perfectly safe, because the whole time I would be there, I'd be thinking, don't believe a word they say. Now, if I went somewhere else where I respected somebody or where I heard, oh, this is a really good speaker or whatever, I'm going to let my guard down and I'm not going to necessarily think as critically. And so there's more chance for things to get in that we really don't want to get in. So this is what I'd like to get at tonight, is the idea of how we need to protect ourselves, and specifically, especially since this is around Christmas time and there's a lot of gushy stuff going on, a lot of touchy-feely, let's all get along because it's Christmas kind of stuff going on. We need to continue to keep our guard up, because there are a lot of things that we're going to hear without even thinking about it that could lead us astray to not really think with a good biblical worldview. Because, as I mentioned here, the smallest things can do the most damage because we're not prepared to face up to it. Now, I'm going to tell a story about several years ago. Actually, it was over 20 years ago. I was watching this movie. Actually, it was a series, but it was on TV, and this was this one particular series about ancient secrets of the Bible. And it was really a very good show in a lot of ways. There was a lot of good stuff that they talked about. They actually talked about the miracles and a lot of the more harder to believe, you could say, things that happen in the Bible. And they talked about it from an evidentialist point of view. Like, they said, well, this could happen because of such and such, and this is very reasonable because of such and such, giving a kind of a scientific analysis and showing that all these things could have happened and that there's evidence why you should believe that this really probably did happen. So it was a really pretty good program. And then at the very end, it was William Devane who was narrating it. Some of you might have remembered him from some movies many years ago. But at the very end, he says, and all this goes to show that the Bible was true all along, and the message of the Bible is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And that was the first time I heard that expression, and I thought, well, that's kind of strange. That's not really what I ever thought of was the main message of the Bible, but it sounds pretty good. I mean, God is our father, and we're all kind of brothers, aren't we? So that kind of put some thoughts in my head that I just thought, well, maybe we are part of a big global family in a lot of ways, and we should see all of the world as our brothers. And so it's kind of putting those thoughts in my head without really thinking about it critically. And even not that all that long ago, I was even looking, well, are there some verses that talk about how God is everyone's father and we're all brothers in some way or another? And the more I looked into it, the more I thought, wow, this is not really going in the direction I was expecting. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit here, because the idea of God as everyone's father and all of us as being brothers is one of those things that can creep into our thinking that we really need to evaluate critically. Now, these are a couple of famous people in church history that started to talk about the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And you can go way back to the 1600s, there was a bishop named Francois, I'll have to have Emily pronounce that for me, but okay. I can pronounce the German guy's name, but not the French guy's name. But he said, all wars are civil because all men are brothers. So he started to teach that in the church to make everybody start to think of all people as brothers. And then you have Voltaire, who was a deist. He had a very skeptical view of God. But he said that he talked about the brotherhood of man himself. And then you have the guy I can pronounce, Friedrich Schleiermacher. That was after several years of German. I had a seminary professor at Reformed Presbyterian Seminary who said, it's okay to use Friedrich Schleiermacher as a swear word. So that tells you how he felt about Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher is considered the father of liberal theology from the early 1800s. And he preached about the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. He was a very, very popular preacher, and a lot of the churches adapted to his way of thinking. And then you have another guy a little bit later in the 1800s during what's called the social gospel movement, which is basically how The essence of the gospel is to go out and help people with their physical needs. And again, is it right to go out and help people with their physical needs? Well, certainly it is, and we're called to do that. But is that the essence of the gospel? I'd say we really need to be careful to think that that's the essence of the gospel. But he also spoke of the fatherhood of God, meaning of the whole world. The whole world has God as our father. And then last of all, this last one's kind of hard to read, but he's the one who really proclaimed it the loudest and affected the teaching within the church the most, a guy named von Harnack. He's the one that's on the right. Schleiermacher's the one on the left. And he was talking basically about the common ground in all religions, or the essence of the Christian faith, is the universal fatherhood of God and the universal brotherhood of man. So this is why we should all get along. And I'm not talking about just fellow believers. I'm talking about everybody in the world. We're all brothers, so we should all think of ourselves that way. And so what does popular culture say about this? This is not just a church thing. This is a popular culture thing as well. Ever heard the song, Here Comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane, written by Gene Autry and Oakley Haldeman? I don't know the second name, but I definitely know the first name. Santa knows we're all God's children. That makes everything right. How many times have you heard that and thought, yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. And then Imagine by John Lennon, no need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. That's pretty touchy-feely, but it sounds kind of nice. And then here's a song called Short People that I always took personally back in the 70s. I don't know if anybody remembers this song, but in this song, Short People, he says, all men are brothers until the day they die. And I even remember that as a kid thinking, this isn't such a bad song, even though it's making fun of me for being short. It's a nice song because it talks about how all men are brothers. And then there was a Disney movie, Hunchback of Notre Dame, probably about 20 years ago or so, and a song called God Help the Outcast, where I believe it was Demi Moore is singing, please help my people, the poor and downtrod. I thought we were all the children of God. And then last of all, one of my songs here, Let There Be Peace on Earth. With God as our Father, brothers all are we. Let me walk with my brother in perfect harmony. When they asked, what songs would you like? I said, just not that one. So here's a song we sing, or we hear. Yeah, we hear it. We sing it and everything. And we get inundated with the idea that God is the Father of everyone and we're all brothers. Now, this is not even specifically saying, oh, that means everybody's a Christian. But it's saying, well, God has this fatherhood over everybody because he created them, right? And we should all have this brotherhood with everybody, without any real distinction between classes or our beliefs or anything like that. Here's a picture I made, a little graphic. If I were a little more computer savvy, I would have done it better than this, but there's always scanning. Draw a picture and scan it if you aren't very good with the computer. This is the notion of God is the Father of all the world, and this is in two senses. In the sense of being the origin of everybody, and we're all made in his image, right? And also in the sense of a relationship. Because to be a father actually has two aspects, right? It's to be the origin and also to be in a relationship. I think about people that I know that have adopted. I've known a number of people who have adopted. Becky has a cousin who's adopted even. And you think about how, is that person, and when I say father, I'm talking about the father and mother here too, really, both parents. Are they really the parents of that child? And then you have to think, well, they didn't give birth to the child, but are they really the parents? Well, there are two parts of being a parent, right? There's being the origin, and there's being in the relationship, the father-child, father and mother-child relationship with the sons and daughters, really. And if you've got one of those, then you really are the parent, except the more meaningful sense of parent is the one that's in the relationship. Because Becky's cousin, for example, who has two children that are adopted, those children have no relationship with their physical parents. So they do have parents that are the source of their origin, but there's no relationship there. So even though those people are their fathers in a technical sense, it's really kind of meaningless, really, because what's more important is Becky's cousin and her husband and how they're raising these children, and they have built this relationship with these children, and that's what's really meaningful. But the picture here is of God as being the father of everybody in both senses, in the sense of the origin and in the sense of the relationship. And you see all the little people there in the world, all men are brothers. And when I say men, forgive me, I'm using a little bit of a sexist term there, but I am referring to how all the people in the world are brothers. But this is where I give the warning. When you hear something over and over and over again, and you aren't using your umbrella, remember I talked about that umbrella, which is a biblical worldview that critiques what you hear, then it's going to sink into your subconscious mind where your presuppositions live. Now, you might think to yourself, I've never heard of somebody talking about where my presuppositions live in my mind. But what are our presuppositions? Our presuppositions are things that we take for granted that we don't even think about. When I go out in the morning, when I go to work, I go out and I start the car and I drive it to work. I don't even think, is this car going to work? Is the engine going to actually function here? No, I just go out and do it. I don't give it a second thought. That's kind of a given. And in our minds, we have all of these presuppositions, all these things that we don't even think about. We don't critique. We don't weigh. We don't measure up. We just run with them. And so when we aren't careful, all these things will sink into our subconscious mind where our presuppositions live. And then eventually they'll all fuse together with the presuppositions we have until they become our presuppositions. When you hear something long enough without critiquing it, without thinking biblically about it, it becomes a part of you. And then if somebody wants to tell you otherwise, it's really hard for them. And that's the danger of the world or of popular culture. Not that being in it is wrong or that coming into contact with the world is wrong, because we have to come into contact with the world. But when we allow it to sink into us without our biblical worldview umbrella, that's when it becomes dangerous. And so that's my whole warning about the small lie or the half-truth. That we don't put up our guard when there's something that sounds like it's mostly true, so we don't worry about it too much. We have to keep our guard up, and we have to keep it up by having a biblical worldview, being grounded in Scripture. So here's the question then. Does the Bible teach the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man? Well, look at it this way. Are we the children of God? Luke 3:38 says that Adam is the son of God. This goes through the whole family tree, going from Christ all the way back to Adam and Eve, and it says Adam is the son of God in Luke 3:38. So you could say, well, okay, Acts 17:26, and he, meaning God, made from one man, Adam, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. So we're all sons of Adam, right? And Adam is a son of God. So in that sense, you could say, okay, we're all sons of God. Everybody in the world, everybody who's ever lived, is a son of God. And again, forgive me for using the sexist language, because I do mean sons and daughters here. But we're all sons of God, right? Acts 17:28, be there. And even some of your own poets, this is Paul speaking. He's speaking about a philosopher named Aretas in 310 to 240 BC. Even some of your own poets have said, we, meaning all of mankind, are his, meaning our Father God's offspring. So Paul is saying this too, right? Paul is saying, we all agree here that we're all God's children. So here are some verses that you can look at and say, okay, all people in the world are God's children. We need to think of them in that way. But then, let's take a look at the New Testament and look at Jesus referring to his physical family, his earthly family. In Matthew 12, starting with verse 46, while he, talking about Jesus here, was still speaking to the people, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside asking to speak to him. And then this is a footnote in the ESV. That's a whole other story why this would be a footnote instead of in the main part of the body. It's in the rest of the text in most translations. But anyway, someone told him, your mother and your brothers are standing outside asking to speak to you. But he replied to the man who told him, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. I used to read that, and that used to really distress me, because I would think, it sounds like Jesus is actually being kind of rude here. Now, it doesn't say, but you can probably surmise that after this, he does go and talk to his brother and his parents, or his mother and his brother and sisters, because Jesus is not rude. He talks to people if they want to talk to him. But the idea of him saying, they're not really my family, my disciples are my family. That's something that really should kind of hit hard, because you have to think to yourself, is there a bond that's even deeper than the physical bond we have with our physical family? And then we have some other verses that make you kind of a little bit uneasy. Mark 3:21, his family thinks he's lost his mind. And even Mary is part of this for a while. Even though Mary is a believer, she still has her moments of doubt. And then John the Baptist also. We know John the Baptist is one of the greatest people who ever lived, and yet he has his moments of doubt. He's Jesus' flesh and blood. He's cousins with him. But John the Baptist asks, are you the one or should we be looking for someone else? If you remember, when he's in prison, he sends his disciples out to say, ask him, is he really the Messiah? John the Baptist, if anyone knows, it should be John the Baptist. And then again, in John 7:5, we have his brothers, his earthly brothers that do not believe in him. And so our physical families are not always our greatest supporters. As everybody knows, at some point or another, you all have family members that have not always been there for you when you needed them. And we want to think, especially as Christians, we value our family so much, but we still have to always make a priority and recognize that there's something that's even deeper than we have with our physical flesh and blood. And that's Mark 6:4. It mentions about that with the prophet is without honor, or is not without honor except in his own town and in his village and in his family. But Jesus talks about his spiritual family. Now, the best case scenario is when your physical family is part of your spiritual family. But there are times when that is not the case, and that's when you have this tension here that I'm talking about. First of all, the term father is Abba. And the term Abba, it's translated as father, but that's translated in a very formal way, in a way that was probably a little bit more formal than the original text connotated, because Abba was really a term for daddy. And what's a more intimate term than daddy? Or you could say a daddy or mommy. Mommy's a pretty intimate term. These are the expressions that babies use. Where do we get these words from? Why do different languages have words like mama, dada, papa, Abba? Because those are the first things that a baby mutters. So a baby is muttering this gibberish, basically, and they say, oh, that means dad, that means mom. Because that's the first thing they learn how to say, and that becomes the most intimate term that they have for their parents. And this is a term that we have for our father. This is not a distant God, as many people in the world will view him to be. But this is an intimate relationship we have with him. Then in Luke 11:22, Jesus is teaching his disciples to pray, and he teaches them our Father, not just Father, but our Father. So the disciples have this right to go to God and call him daddy, basically. And he's not telling everybody to pray like that. He's telling his disciples to pray like that. We know that Jesus is the unique son, but we are sons also through adoption. We're not born that way. We're not born in this father-son or parent-child as I'm picturing here, we're not born into that relationship. We're born separated from God. And it's when God adopts us that we become that way. So think about people that you know that have adopted. Think about how they went through this long, arduous process, because adoption is not an easy thing. Going through the difficulty of adoption because they want somebody to love as their own, to have that intimate relationship with. And that baby doesn't really have anything to do with it. That baby was just born. But the parents go out and try to find that child to adopt, just like our Father does for us. Galatians 4:5-7. To redeem those who are under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. And then John 1:12, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God. And that translation, I think, is a little bit loose, saying children instead of son. We say children because we want people to realize we're talking about males and females. But in reality, when it says son, son is also synonymous with heir. So when we become his children, we become his sons in the sense that we are heirs. If it had said sons and daughters, it would have been a little bit weaker, because it wouldn't have had the implication of heirs. But since it says sons, and it does mean males and females, we know from other verses, whoever he adopts, whether male or female, they become his heirs. We have a right to his inheritance because he gives it to us. This goes far beyond, as God as our Father, brothers all are we, let's live together in perfect harmony. When you look out into the world, do you see harmony? Now, you don't even always see harmony in the church, but there is a possibility for harmony in the church because of this shared relationship we have with our Father God. And because of the relationship that He has given us with each other, we have that potential to live in harmony, as hard as it might be. But the people in the world that don't have that, there's no way they can live in harmony, at least not for any length of time. It's going to always be unstable. And if you look at the history of the world, it's always been unstable. There have always been wars and people killing each other. So then let's see who is not Jesus' spiritual family. And this is from Matthew 8, 30 through 47. As He was saying these things, many believed in Him. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in Him, "If you abide in My word, you are truly My disciples." So what is a disciple? Someone who believes in Him, believes in His word. "And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered Him, "We are offspring of Abraham." Now we're getting into the physical family here. They're starting to prioritize, this is what my bloodline is. "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone." These are not necessarily believers He's talking to now. There were believers in the first verse that many people believed to, but now He's talking to people who are not necessarily believers. "How is it you say you will become free?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." So Jesus is saying, you have a different father than I do. They answered Him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works of Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. How can you tell who your father is? Because you reflect your father in some way or another." They reflect their father just as Jesus reflected His father. And we should, especially as we grow in grace, we should reflect our father too. "You are doing the works your father did," they said to Him. "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but He sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." That picture we have of Jesus, meek and mild, always like helping people and sitting children on their knees, is only part of the story. Because this is the same Jesus saying this, saying, you are not part of my family. You're the family of the devil. "But because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? I tell you the truth. Why do you not believe me? Whoever's of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God." So in conclusion here, not everyone is our brother. Are we called to love only our brothers, though? And you have to think about that. To answer that question, you have to go to the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. Are we supposed to only love people within our family, only love our brothers? Yeah, who is our neighbor? Basically, love your neighbor as yourself. And they say, who is my neighbor? Basically, your neighbor is everybody, including your enemies. Because the Jews hated the Samaritans, and the Samaritans hated the Jews. But God shows how they are neighbors. And they're to love each other with that same love. This is the way we love our neighbors. But our neighbors are not the same as our brothers. We don't have that same intimate tie with our neighbors that we do with our brothers. Here's another little drawing that I think hopefully explains the way things are in a more biblical perspective. God is the Father, but to be a father means two things, as I mentioned. To be the origin. In other words, all people are created in God's image because God is their origin, their creator. But also there's the sense of the relationship and the intimacy. And so you can see from the little diagram here, all the people in the world originate from God because they're made by Him in His image. And they're all neighbors in that sense. And we should view everybody as neighbors that we're to love as we love ourselves. But those who are adopted are the ones who can truly call God Father. And they're the ones that are the believers. Those are the ones that are brothers. So is God everyone's father, and are all men brothers? In the origin sense, yes. But in the relationship or the intimate sense, no. What do people mean when they say that? To say that God is everyone's father and we're all brothers is like filling a balloon with so much air that it pops. In other words, using meaningless words. It's like a light rain shower without an umbrella. In other words, we're in danger of being infiltrated with half-truths. And also like the cross-eyed Mona Lisa. In other words, just a little bit off ruins the whole thing. So in a relational sense, only believers are sons of God and brothers of one another. That is the family of God. All people are born into a world, are born into a broken relationship with God, and only believers are adopted. Only believers can really cry out, Abba, Father, and it mean anything. Only believers can pray, Our Father. Only believers are brothers with one another with the same intimacy that we experience, although imperfectly, in our own families. So we understand intimacy from our physical families, and that's used as an analogy so we can understand the intimacy that we have with fellow believers. And something else that is, I think, the most profound thing of all, we have a bond with believers in blank. Fill in the blank. Madagascar, Timbuktu, Paramaribo, Ouagadougou, Straw Pump. Thinking of the most exotic places I could think of, Straw Pump being one of them here. That we lack with our unbelieving friends, neighbors, and family, though we are still to love them as we love ourselves. So you can see, we have a special relationship with all believers that we do not have with other people. And as believers and believers only, God is our Father and brothers all are we. What kind of implications does that have for example, praying for the persecuted church? The people in the persecuted church are our brothers. What implication does that have even for just getting together with fellow believers? When you feel like, I can worship God on my own. I don't really need to be with other people. God and I have this thing going on. We don't need other people around. We need each other because we are family. And we have a sense of family that nobody else has. And so we really don't want to squander that. When you go away, if you're out of town and it's a Sunday and you have the opportunity to go worship somewhere and you think, I don't really want to worship here. I don't know these people. This is not my denomination. I don't know what to think of this. I'd really rather, God and I can still have our own thing going on here. But if you're somewhere else, it's really beneficial to go worship with people that you don't know, as long as you know it's a Bible-believing church, because they're still your brothers too. And it's good to see that brotherhood. And you experience something, at least I've experienced this, when you go to a church where you don't know anybody, but you know that they're true believers, that bond is there. You can sense that bond there because even though you've never met them before, we have that going on in the family of God that we do not have with people outside of us. And that's all I have for tonight. But I want you to conclude, especially this time of year, as you're hearing all of these things about, you know, how we should all get along and we all love each other and Santa Claus loves everybody and Jesus wants you to sit on his lap and he'll just tell you all kinds of nice things about you and everything. Let's recognize the relationship that we have with God as our Father. Our Father who loves us sacrificially, but who also chastens us when we do wrong. A relationship we can understand best when we think about our own parents and the relationship we have with each other that's different from what we have with the rest of the world. Not to say anything bad about the relationship we have with the rest of the world, because we're to love the rest of the world. But there's something even deeper within the family of God. So thank you for your time tonight. And if the ushers would come up, then we can have a collection here.